But you try to look back at the things that you didn't do and you should have done. You look at the things that you have been towards that person, how much friendship you had for one time, and suddenly the friendship is destroyed. Well, the vital life power has to make some kind of reconciliation between the two individuals, that they will now remember, well, he was good to me, why should I be this harsh on him? And the other makes the same, what you say, adjustments. And he says now, oh, let the wickedness of the wicked come to an end. That means within his own self, he's got to end the feud or the craving or the desire to continue the knocking back. But establish the just, for the righteous God tried the hearts and reins. That means once we learn to use our judgment and we correct the karma, the palpitation of the heart starts correcting itself, and the adrenals where the anger or the tension is released, the adrenaline is released, they start to correct themselves. So we have now a physical adjustment occurring in human beings. He says, God judges the righteous now. This life force is going to come to task. Here he says, my defense is of God, which saveth the upright in heart. The initiate has hurt someone, but he's appealing on behalf of his past good deeds for some type of clemency. Deep down in his heart, he did not intentionally want to hurt another man. Deep down in our hearts, we don't intentionally want to hurt people. But somewhere along, anger can trigger it off. Desire can cause us to make a wrong decision, and we hurt the other person, and then the feud goes on until it has to be reconciled. Now, God judges the righteous, and God is angry with the wicked every day. That's quite a statement. The righteous are judged, and the wicked is angry with. He's not angry with you, the righteous, and he don't judge the wicked. Do you see it?
Well, the righteous would only be the person that comes to the realization that he has to clear his own consciousness.
All right, and the wicked?
The wicked is the person that hasn't got there yet, but he's on his way.
Good. So the wicked is constantly generating adrenaline in his system, and the righteous is now shutting down the adrenaline and must face the consequences for triggering it off. So you are judged by your own body relationship and body action and desire. So the life force is angry with the individual who is constantly negative. That means the life force will emit into the negative individual more and more adrenaline. It will not stabilize itself. But the person who is righteous now, who has hurt someone and is going to make some stabilization, he must pay the consequences. He must live through the experience of self-correction. Judgment means you have been assessed and you must pay the price. In some way, you must make an atonement. Some way of ameliorating that situation.
Which has to be done on a conscious level?
Yes. It must be done on a conscious level in a physical body.
Does that negate the karma?
Yes, it does negate the karma.
Any karma that is not irreversible? Is all karma reversible?
Yes. We will see it now, how he's saying it. If he turn not, see, this is the statement, if he turn not, he will wet his sword. He hath bent his bow and made it ready. He hath also prepared for him the instruments of death. He ordained his arrows against the persecutors. You see the punishment that follows through the action. Behold, he travaileth with iniquity, and hath conceived mischief, and brought forth falsehood. He made a pit and digged it, and is fallen into the ditch which he made. That's the very man who committed the karma. He's done all these things.
These desire patterns would lead him to that end.
Right. His mischief shall return upon his own head. See? He's being judged, you see? How he's being judged. This is not, not the angry Lord,
is it? It was already set up in consciousness. He had asked for it on a conscious level to rectify this situation. Well, then it would have just worked itself out, and he would have got an arrow
through his own karmic condition. Right. Somebody would have shot him.
Right.
Okay. And his violent dealing shall come down upon his own pit, his own noggin, you know. You see, this is actual karma. The whole principle of karma is here, right? It's not laid out. You see? Now he says, I will praise the Lord according to his righteousness. Oh, well, you know, he can't say anything else. I'm shot, Lord. I don't hurt my enemy now. It's my own fault. I enjoy my punishment, my judgment. The righteous is judged now. He's judged to face the karmic condition and go through it because he triggered it off himself. And he should not complain no more. He should be glad to go through it and recognize it. All these things were all set up by his own thought pattern. So the judgment comes back on his head. So he says, I will praise the Lord according to his righteousness. So he said, it could have been worse, Lord. And will sing his praise to the name of the Lord Most High. That means, I accept my punishment and it could have been worse. In other words, you could have taken away my life. See, because actually, he was destined by the karmic pattern of hurting someone to lose his life.
If he had persisted with the desire patterns, well, it would have led him to that, but he realized it before this happened.
Quite true. Therefore, we must make adjustment or amends for anyone that we've hurt in some way before it comes to the final end. And before we ourselves leave the physical frame, because we will have to do it over again. See, the physical frame is the testing ground for reconciliation. That's why when Jesus came on the body, he told Peter, when Peter asked him, Master, how many times should we forgive our fellow men? And he said, Jesus, 70 times 7, that's 490 attempts. And then he said, walk the extra mile with him before the sun goes down.
Because we don't know how many seeds we've sown.
Right, and we don't know if we live through the night. You see? So you have to make this particular effort because we are judged by our particular effort. Now, the glory of God is displayed in creation. Our Lord God, how excellent is thy name in all the earth, who has set thy glory above the heavens. After we understand karma now, which is the last psalm, we go in to see now what is called the purpose of living. See, the Psalms are designed now to carry you through the affirmative life or the science of living. And it's called the glory of God displayed in creation. So the initiate who wrote this said, O Lord, our glory, how excellent is thy name in all the earth. In other words, O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the earth. That means the sun current. How beautiful this sun current has come into manifestation as a universe. Who has set thy glory above the heavens? The sun current is way above the audible formation of matter. Good, all right. You can't have that obvious then. Because of thine enemies, that thou mightest still the enemy and the avenger. We have to realize that if we have an enemy, or caused someone to be our enemy, there is that particular condition called avenging, or vengeance. It's the next psychological level we will go to. Someone must seek to avenge. If you hurt somebody and to the point that that person is dead, his kinfolk or someone related would want to avenge that person. So we are put in a situation like that.
Back on the karma, he says something about if he did something unknowing, if he hurt this person with his thoughts and his unknowingly, well, there must be some indication that this is he had done this.
Yes.
The person was throwing spears at him or something,
uh-huh.
Something like that. Yeah. So, you can make restitution. The person doesn't have to be physically present. You can do it in consciousness.
Uh-huh.
And as long as you do that, well, is there going to be some indication that this has been accepted by the Lord?
It's accepted by the Lord, but it doesn't say that you are absolved by the Lord. The Lord will still want some little measurement of payment to remind you. If you were supposed to be struck by the spear in your heart and die, now you'll have something that'll stick you someplace and leave a scar to remind you. You have to pay for it in some way, but not in the drastic way it was intended to come back to you.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. Then if that's what Paul was talking about, he had a good race and his body was scarred by the, it says he had scars and marks on his body to prove that he had run a good race.
Good. Okay. So we do have to carry some kind of a marking on ourselves. When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, that is the evaluation now. And you begin to look at these things around you and see how insignificant our thought patterns are in terms of hurting one another. Then you begin to realize how stupid we are to want to maintain a constant conflict between another human being. You can't even make a finger, let alone the moon and the stars. So how are we going to really say to ourselves, we're not so smart? We're not smart. We're actually being stubborn. So the glory of our environment is the challenge to help us realize ourselves and try to correct the mistakes with one another. Then he says, what is man that thou art mindful of him? He's asking the Creator. Why should the Lord be interested in a human being? And the Son of Man, that means the offspring, that thou visitest him. There must be something in man and the offspring of man that the Creator would be interested in him or would be totally involved in him. Now he describes how man comes into existence. For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels. He tells you exactly how man is designed. He gives you a complete archetypal pattern, a little lower than the angels. You see, man is made a little lower than the angels. But because he made him a little lower than the angels, that he should be interested in man, he's got to have something in him that is greater than the angels. He may be made a little lower than the angels, architecturally speaking, but not decoratively speaking. See the difference? You can have a rinky-dinky old looking house, but beautifully decorated inside. And you can have a beautiful mansion next door, all painted up outside and inside it all falling apart. So he's describing the contrast between man and the angel. For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor. Now we are only the type of creature that has glory and honor involved in our existence, this human mechanism. The plants don't have it, animals don't have it, etheric beings or angels don't have it. They are only servants of the Lord. They are what we call the spiritual transformers of the vital life power. But they don't have the glory and the honor. That means they are not elevated by their conscious efforts to experience divine oneness. We are elevated by our conscious efforts for divine oneness. That's why man ought to be perfect, even his Father which is in heaven. Thou madest him to have dominion, now the power he's giving him, over the works of thy hands, that even the angel may have the power to work the creation, but he doesn't have the power to dominate the creation. Thou madest him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet. Well, that's a very interesting statement, if you realize that. In these two hands, you can control the universe. And in your feet, you have all the nerve endings of the human body, which is a miniature universe. And yet in your hands, you have all the nerve endings again coming through them, like a miniature universe. The human hands are the only mechanism that can play the intricate pieces of music. And the human feet is a chart of the vital life principle in the human body. Man is designed that way. He can track every nerve ending in his feet, and he can manipulate these fingers as an expression of his divinity. All sheep and oxen, yea, and the beasts of the field, the fowl of the air and the fish of the sea, and whatsoever passes through the paths of the sea. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the world. In other words, the Shabbat, the Sankaran, the name, is the actual force that is in resident in man. And this is where man has his dominion. Man is selected by the Creator to hear the sound current or the name and to make this force work in himself. And as long as he hears this sound current inside, he is identified with the Lord. That's why when the waves started to come up and the Master Jesus was lying in the boat sleeping, fully aware of what was going on in the minds of his disciples and what was happening around in the environment, in a superconscious way, the disciples in their subconscious level of memory of being drunk by high waves and of their conscious awareness that the ship was flooding with water, they began to panic. But the Master is a master. He is man who has realized the dominion over all the forces. He stood up and rebuked the waves, the sound current. He is the epitome of the Sankarat. He is the living Sankarat. He alone can stop all the creation that is created out of the same Sankarat. When a human being realizes this, that he is in possession of this power, then he can demonstrate it. He can show his dominance over it. And he says, how excellent is thy name in all the earth, meaning the reverence for his Sankarat. Then the initiate David goes on to praise God for the execution of his judgment. Once he begins to realize what he's living in, he's got now to realize why God's law must work, why karma is a valid law. It is the only law that really satisfies all the problems in our existence. Therefore, he starts the psalm by saying, I will praise thee, O Lord, with my whole heart. Now, he's not leaving out one segment of his heart or feeling or his mind. With the whole heart, with the whole mind, I will show forth all thy marvelous works. In other words, I'm willing to be involved in creation. I'm not avoiding it. I'm not running from it. The initiate does not run. He does not avoid. He's committed and he's involved. Once he understands his origin, then he takes on the involvement. And the involvement leads to his emergence or his divinity on a conscious level. I will be glad. That's a positive affirmation of an attitude of how to live with your involvement. And rejoice in thee. And this is doing it in a conscious level, in the present tense. I will sing praise to thy name, O thou most high. So chanting the psalms or the mantras is an indication of hallowing or spiritualizing this force, bringing this current to work on a conscious level. When we chant and raise our consciousness up, the vibrations in the room tends to pull up and you are raised to that state of awareness. When my enemies are turned back, they shall fall and perish in thy presence. These are all the desire patterns. For thou hast maintained my right and my cause, and thou sittest in the throne judging right. Well, if the Creator is judging us, that's the vital life power, and it is maintaining for my cause, that's the initiate's cause. What is the initiate's cause? The initiate's cause is the involvement, not to run from the karmic conditions around him. Because it's cause and effect, the law of action. Once it's initiated into action, that has to be lived out. And therefore the divine intelligence sits in bringing this principle into manifestation. Thou hast rebuked the heathen. Remember, I used the word heathen earlier. It's repeating itself again. Thou hast destroyed the wicked. You see, we come back with the same thought. Of their name forever and ever. These thought patterns are removed from our consciousness. And we have to realize that the negative forces are within us. And once we raise it, our consciousness, to the level where we can accept the karmic responsibility, then the desires don't have the impact. But if your desire nature comes to an end, It is the perpetual end. It's the end of the repetition. To him that overcometh, I will not send forth a second time. This, again, is the understanding involved in the desire pattern. O thou enemy, the structures are come to an end. That is the repercussions of thought pattern in the form of desire. And thou hast destroyed cities. Not a human being. Human being is only the end result of the desire pattern triggering off to go destroy, tear down the establishment. You don't, a robot can't tear down anything. It must have to be programmed or primed. A human being cannot tear down something until he has a desire or the craving. So the real culprit behind it all is the desire nature. That is the condition that tears down. It says, O thou enemy, the structures are come to perpetual end, and thou hast destroyed cities, their memorial is perished with them. That is to say, desire leads us to self-destruction. But the Lord shall endure forever. That is life. It will continue to exist forever, regardless of how much your desire pattern is triggered off. He had prepared his throne for judgment. Life has set up in creation the law of cause and effect, or karma, to reconcile all desire patterns. And he shall judge the world in righteousness. Karma, which is the way of bringing things to a head, will make our environment the testing ground for the positive thought patterns against the negative thought patterns. Righteousness is the right thought pattern, not positive thought. And he shall minister judgment to the people in uprightness. The moment you accept your responsibility and your karmic debt, you're going to be pulled up by the roots. As the yogi says, we pull you up by your choti. In other words, you're going to force to face yourself now. You're going to eat your own words back. And some of those words are pretty rough at times. You know, those adjectives or pronouns, they stick in your throat. But that's how the upright person, the ethical person, the spiritual person or the initiate is made whole again by that principle. He's made one with the divine current. The Lord also will be a refuge. When you are eating your words back, where do your thoughts go now? What is your most thoughts in your what is uppermost in your mind? The Lord also will be a refuge for the oppressed, a refuge in times of trouble. When you're eating your words and they're really oppressing you, you find out that you are recalling or resorting back to the divine current in you. You are trying to recapture those moments of bliss prior to your mistakes with your desires. And you wish you never did trigger out that pattern to cause you to eat your words back. So the same condition that upbraids you is the same condition that comforts you. You begin to understand your nature better. And they that know my name, the individual who is hallowing the song, the name in his mind now, that's the initiate, they that know my name, will put their trust in thee. For thou, Lord, hast not forsaken them that seek thee. The initiate will make mistakes, but if he keeps hallowing the name with all his mistakes and eating his word back, he will find refuge, he will find emergence. He will live through his involvement. He knows his origin, he knows his involvement, his commitments, and now he's given the key to get out of it and to sustain himself. Repetition of the holy name. Hallowing the holy name. Hallowing the chant, or hallowing the psalm. The psalm means extrasensory aid. Calling upon that aid, those thought patterns laid out by the initiate experience, and bringing it through to lift yourself up. Now he says the initiate goes out to sea. And they that know thy name will put their trust in thee, for thou, Lord, hast not forsaken them that seek thee. Sing praises to the Lord. Chant. Now, the colored people always say when you're in the blues, to do what? Sing away the blues. You see, on a practical level, singing does break up that particular experience around you that puts you in a blue or low mood. Sing the praises to the Lord which dwelleth in Zion, which means generate the chant current, which is residing in the brain. The sound current is here already at the eye center. But chant with your mind centered there, Mount Zion. This is Mount Zion. Chant with your consciousness centered there. If you say, Om, or whatever you're chanting, how sweet the name of whatever you're chanting. Listen, 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 anything. Once you are chanting with your consciousness here, you're declaring above the people the principles of the inner life. So he says, sing the praises to the Lord which dwelleth in Zion, declare among the people his doings. As you start chanting, this particular consciousness is being pulled up, and people now start to get into you. They start to feel the pull. They want to participate. When he maketh inquisition for blood, he remembered them. He forgetteth not the cry of the humble. That's a very drastic statement. He remembereth them. He forgetteth not the cry of the humble. When we go out to the extent to hurt others, that's an inquisition. Putting them to the torture chamber. Embarrassing them in every way for blood. In other words, we don't have no compassion, we don't have no mercy. But the creative life principle remembers those people. He forgetteth not the cry of the humble. Many of us are hurt unwillingly, unknowingly, unintentionally, and we cry out. Those cries cannot be forgotten, because those cries come from the heart, come from the mind. They're set into motion in the atmosphere. They are thought patterns. They have to be resolved. Now, we are using life force. God is life force. And once we are using it, it's hanging in the air to face us. And therefore, we have to live through the experience of reconciling it. So here is the reconciliation. Have mercy upon me, O Lord. Consider my trouble, which I suffer of them that hate me. Thou that liftest me up from the gates of death. You see how far we have to go in the emotional nature of ourselves to be free from the karmic responsibility, right up to the point of death. Death is the final test. If we are going to be willing to correct the wrong of having hurt someone, if we're going to be willing to seek some type of reconciliation for our mistakes, it's human to avoid, but it's divine to face up. You only have the strength to face up when you accept the divine in you. And that is, if God be with you, who can be against you? You see, he has provided that for you to ease your mind so that you can face the problems that you've generated. So you have a way out by accepting your divinity in yourself. And in so doing, you will face yourself and you will face the problems with the fellow men who you have hurt for the first time. Then there is no more avoidance, but then there is release, emergence. You're liberated, free man all, lord of yourself. This is the inner awareness of yourself at work. That I may show forth all thy praise in the gates of the daughter of Zion, I will rejoice in thy salvation. The moment we accept ourselves, that by looking the point between the eyebrows and facing the problem, half of the battle is won already. Because strength comes in to face the situation. And you will rejoice in thy salvation, because that means you are coming to the release now. The pressure is off. You know, when you begin to face some situation, you are kind of leery as to how you'll face it. You die a thousand deaths before you actually face it. But the moment you start going through it, things fall into place, and when you come through it, you end up saying, it could have been worse. It's by this particular facing it, certain forces begin to work towards helping you. The prodigal son, when he decided to go back to his father, when he decided to face his father for having squandered his sustenance, died a thousand deaths. But until he turned around to go back, he didn't know if his father was going to meet him halfway and accept him. Equally true, when we as human beings make a blunder or some action that we feel guilty of, and we want to correct it, we will die a thousand deaths till we face it. The moment we face it, it starts moving. We are bringing into focus our divinity for the first time. A strength comes in us that helps us to live above the impact of the condemnation from the individual who we are asking to forgive us. There is where the strength of humility versus the strength of ego. The person who is going to forgive you may be highly egotistic, highly antagonistic. You who are humble and realizing what you're doing on a conscious level can win the battle now with love for the first time. You're applying love and you are free. The heathen are sunk in the pit that they made. In the net which they hid is their own foot taken. By the very things we plant for others, we are trapped into it. But at the same time, we can correct it. The Lord is known by the judgment which he executed. That means karma will always come back to the individual. The wicked is snared in the work of his own hand. You can't constantly tear down others without you going to be teared down. Now we come into a beautiful Jewish word. It's called, or Hebrew word, Hig Gayon. It's spelled Hig-Gayon. Then we have another Hebrew word, Selah. Selah, we know, is so be it. Higayon is, it has been said. It's stated now that the Lord will make restitution by his own principles. This is not something that we can never avoid no more. This is something we have to face. That means something is set into motion by the creative intelligence will never alter itself. It will upbraid us, it will help us, it will chasten us, admonish us, but it is the only way that we can ever find real inner joy. is by living it out. The Creator does not make two ways. He has one way. What we sow, we reap. Yet, in that very principle, though it's harsh in times, based upon the desire pattern of the individual who trigger it off, or the particular life form you find yourself working it out, yet if you're willing to face it, you will discover the uniqueness of your divinity in it. That's the only way you'll ever do it. To discover your uniqueness of your divinity is by facing it. You will discover how much spiritual power is latent in you by facing it. So he goes on to say, the wicked shall be turned into hell and all the nations that forget God. We're finding a very strange statement. The wicked shall be turned into hell. Well, we're not talking about H-E-L-L, merely as some place where somebody with a pitchfork and a big fire is waiting for you. It really means on the initiate life that those thought patterns that are self-deteriorating will go into a state of hell, meaning it will be crystallized to constantly confront you and wait for you to have the experience of confrontation in order to correct it. It will be put in that particular situation where you have to make the correction in yourself. It's stored up for you. And all the nations that forget God, that means all the environmental laws that tend to deviate from that principle, they will all have to remain in this state of hell. For the needy shall not always be forgotten. Yes, now you see the word needy and not want, the needy. The expectation of the poor shall not perish forever. So, needy people, expectant people, are involved in this process. What is in a human being as an initiate, all our needs are fulfilled, not our wants. And the poor means those who lack the spiritual drive, the spiritual initiative in themselves. They are poor. When we lack this spiritual urge or spiritual craving to understand ourselves, we are really poor. It has nothing to do with money. It has strictly to do with a lack of spiritual drive, spiritual yearning. But if their expectation, he says, the expectation of the spiritual poor, if you're constantly expecting to alter yourself, to improve yourself, you will not perish. That means there is hope for the individual who may lack the initiative to spiritually improve himself, but if he expects to make a change, sooner or later he will be pulled out by grace. He will not be left or cut abandoned. The life energy will not leave him. Arise, O Lord, the energy moving up the spine. Let no man prevail, let not the ego be in control. The Kundalini energy must rise up in the spine so that the ego is held in check. Let the heathen be judged in thy sight. Let the sensory nature face the realization that the vital power moves up to the top of the brain. Put them in fear. That means let the sensory nature realize that the intuitive power is supreme. is extrasensory. We are limited by our five senses. We are unlimited by our extrasensory forces. Put them in fear, O Lord, that the nations may know themselves to be but men. In other words, people don't realize that when they live by their sensory nature, they are limited. But when they live by their extrasensory nature, they are unlimited. The initiate is making a statement that we are only men when we live by our sensory nature, but we are sons of God or sons of light, divine being in manifestation, when we live by our extrasensory nature or our divine nature, when we bring this nature to bear or into manifestation, when we cause it to come out and work, we are different. We are no longer men. Now Jesus said, if the Son of Man be lifted up, I will draw all other men to me. If the sensory nature is withdrawn from the lower chakras of the body and centered in the brain, all other people living in that sensory nature will be also be drawn and magnetically pulled up. Thank you.
This is the 10th psalm, the psalm of complaint and prayer. Why standest thou afar off, O Lord? Why hidest thou thyself in times of trouble? The wicked in his pride doth persecute the poor. Let them be taken in the devices that they have imagined. For the wicked boasteth of his heart's desire, and blesseth the covetous whom the Lord abhorreth. The wicked, through the pride of his countenance, will not seek after God. God is not in all his thoughts. His ways are always grievous. Thy judgments are far above out of his sight. As for all his enemies, he puffeth at them. He hath said in his heart, I shall not be moved, for I shall never be in adversity. His mouth is full of cursing and deceit and fraud. Under his tongue is mischief and vanity. He sitteth in the lurking places of the villages. In the secret places doth he murder the innocent. His eyes are privily set against the poor. He lieth in wait secretly as a lion in his den. He lieth in wait to catch the poor. He doth catch the poor when he draweth him into his net. He croucheth and humbleth himself, that the poor may fall by his strong ones. He hath said in his heart, God hath forgotten. He hideth his face, he will never see it. Arise, O Lord, O God, lift up thine hand. Forget not the humble. Wherefore doth the wicked condemn God? He hath said in his heart, thou wilt not require it. Thou hast seen it, for thou beholdest mischief and spite, to requite it with thy hand. The poor committeth himself unto thee. Thou art the helper of the fatherless. Break thou the arm of the wicked and the evil man. Seek out his wickedness till thou find none. The Lord is king for ever and ever. The heathen are perished out of his land. Lord, thou hast heard the desire of the humble. Thou wilt prepare their heart. Thou wilt cause thine ear to hear. To judge the fatherless and the oppressed, that the man of the earth may no more oppress.
Well, that's sure lays it on for life, modern day living. We are to
many of us in the initiates often ask the same question before we come into the initiate life, when we are searching for truth. Why standest thou afar in the world? How many of us have ever asked the same question? We've all asked that. We've all made that tremendous appeal. Never fully realizing that God is not afar. And what he fails to realize is that God can't be seen. That's what we say in the scripture, no man sees God. God is the eternal vital power in us. It's the creative principle. Now the creative principle works by laws. And these laws are around us. And when we're involved in them, that is where we learn our lessons. When we avoid them, we learn a bitter lesson. It's in the avoidance we learn the real lesson, not in the avoidance. So we say, why hidest thou thyself in times of trouble? Have we not all gone through this particular experience? When things are really going bad, that's the time we're crying for God, and he doesn't seem to appear. And then all of a sudden, the ego wakes up one morning and says, hey, wait a minute, you don't exist. What am I beating my head against the wall for? What really exists is me. Me big ego. I'm the only real thing that exists. So if me big ego is existing, and the creative intelligence is not existing, then creative intelligence can't see nothing. In this human body, the ego then takes full advantage of that particular situation. And then it goes to be exactly what is laid out in the science. It's by the boastful experience of trying to control humanity. The wicked in his pride. That means the ego automatically comes puffed up in us. When we are in stress, we don't see any avenging force. When we call upon this force to help us, it doesn't respond. Therefore, automatically the mind assumes that no creative intelligence will be there to judge us or interfere. So the ego is a big, big part of the problem in the growth of man, in his unfolding. When the initiate wrote the psalm, he wrote of the inner life, this conflict that goes on in everyday activity between the ego and the higher self. He knew that there was no way that the creative intelligence would come down and literally clobber him on the head if he made a mistake. So he allowed the ego to really go all out, only to discover that this is the worst thing he could have done. So the psalm is called a psalm of complaint and prayer. First you have to complain because nothing is coming in from the creative intelligence. And then sooner or later you have to discover that your desires are not being fulfilled. Then prayer or intercession begins in us. This is what the science of the soul teaches us. It teaches us that we must first understand the creative principle and our relationship with it before we can actually bring it into manifestation. So it says, the wicked in his pride doth persecute the poor. The ego takes advantage of the lesser developed individuals, the thought patterns that have no real value. Poor, they can't fend for themselves, they can't take care of themselves. Those desires attempt to be very, very weak. The ego starts hitting them down. Let them be taking in the devices that they have imagined. Now, in our imagination, we can have many types of cravings, and the ego can start to generate a particular desire. desire to control him. Once it starts to control the human being, then we are a victim of the ego. Now, the only reason we are in the body, the only reason we are reincarnating, is because we have an unfulfilled desire. But an unfulfilled desire is also like a habit pattern. It's a craving that keeps craving, that keeps craving, and keeps arguing, and keeps wanting more and more. And since you can't satisfy it, sooner or later it becomes a chronic habit pattern. And since it becomes a chronic habit pattern, then we find we have been taken in. We are addicted. So, psychologically, we are addicted to our own imagination through the craving patterns. Therefore, as we become addicted, we have to repeat it over and over and over. Then we become attached. From the addiction comes the attachment. You can't seem to let go. And if we want to let go, we're afraid that we're going to lose ourselves, our identity. That's the problem in this ego nature. Yet, when you realize that by detaching yourself, breaking free from your imagination of what will happen to you, in the process, you start the elimination of holding on to unfulfilled desires. The unfulfilled desires begin to shut off. Now, the third verse says, for the wicked boasteth in his heart's desire, and blessed the covetous whom the Lord abhorreth. The negative person always tries to generate some kind of facade. In order to pull us in, disturb some kind of a whirlpool, to pull us into that whirlpool. They're always boasting of how good the sensory life is. Now, if the sensory life is so good, the evidence we have is a death. Spiritual man is not worried about his life while he's living. He knows it's a process in which he's involved. And the process is sanctified by the Creator. Then he's ready to leave the body. Only at that time we will see what the true spiritual man is. Spiritual man is not absorbed by his miracles that he performed. He is sanctified by the creative presence, by the creative principle, by the grace. Then that power decides to raise him up at death. We begin to see now an unusual phenomenon occurring in the spiritual man's life. He may be very humble, very simple living, great persecution. He may not involve himself in the sensory nature or the cravings of the entire world. He may look upon as a, what the people call, a type of a teetotaler. He's not an individual, he's not a sport teacher. He's not the kind that gets involved with things that are make the life worth living. The sensory nature tries to create all types of propaganda to indicate that the sensory life is the highest life while you're in the body. But while the sensory life is doing that, the spiritual man knows that this is a trap. He knows says this is honey with poison in it. And if he sticks his finger in it and put it in his mouth, it may be sweet, but it may be death at the same time. The spiritual man has to be aware of the sensual nature of man.
Who are locked up